Going to talk this morning about death and dying. And I think that we should do it in the context of a little thing that Carol and I, with some help from some other people, are doing. It's part of a family life series, and we're the last book in the series. And knowing Carol and myself, I'm sure it will be the last one written if we ever complete it. But we have already made some progress towards it, because a lot of it is on tape. It's in, they haven't sent the tape back because there's some discussion and controversy going on with regards to a publisher and so forth.
As to who has the right to publish it.
That's right. Who has the right to publish?
You mean you or Carol?
No, whether it's Concordia or Augsburg. Yes. And we had a dialogue on death last fall, a very interesting one, and that's on tape. Fritz Norstedt was to have joined us, but he came early. But if any of you ever have the chance, I recommend that you go in and listen to that Vesper service that he had. I don't know what the name of it was, but he was describing, it was a Vesper service in which he described the death of his 28-year-old daughter. We have discussed death, I guess, every year, or almost every year that I have been on the program here. It's a very important thing to me. I think it is very important that we talk about life's most dramatic moment and how to approach it. I hope that this year will be a little easier than last year. Just about 1 year ago, I was scheduled on to talk on death at 11. At 8:30, Carol Cole came and told me that my mother had just died. Now, I want to give a couple of readings here, and then I'm going to give you the structure of our book, and we're going to talk somewhat in the context of that. I'm going to spend a good deal of time on the referring to a book on death and dying, because it's a very good book. But first, I want to read just a couple of things that is my sort of habit, I guess, it's that I've gotten into, to often read from George MacDonald. And he said, "We die daily. Happy those who daily come to life as well." And it was Cliff, I think, Listug, who told me this at some conference I was in Southern California with the youth. He said, "To believe in God is to die and not be embarrassed." And Willie gave me an interesting book when he saw me carrying on death and dying. He said, "You should read this little thing that I have that some of my associates put together, I think some students. It's called Fooling Around with Jesus, or Clowning Around with Christ, or God's Son is Revolting." And it says, "Man is a three-letter word, and so is sin. And man and sin are not meant to mix, for man to sin is death. It is the fall and the curse all over again, every day and every way, forever and ever. Amen. And next to God, the strongest force on earth is death. Death happens as soon as men reject God and exalt themselves. Cause when men exalt themselves, when men think that they are important in their own right, it causes division. Division from God, division from each other." And I have a little cartoon here. It says, "Now what have you completed? Now that you have completed your 30-year investigation of the problem of human mortality, could you tell us your conclusions?" And the other person answers, "When you're dead, you're dead." And then the division, and it tells what division leads to, and it names, it's a whole column of just about everything. And it said, "The probe has just begun." And I certainly recommend this book. So you'll have to ask Willie for a copy, as I am going to ask him. And he said, "Death is as a lifestyle. The Bible calls death as a lifestyle living in sin. And the lifestyle of death is a continual denial of God and God's creative power in the world. Whenever man tries to give himself an ideology, the dollar, a pleasure, more authority than God, he is living the lifestyle of death. And giving ourselves an ideology, the dollar or a pleasure, more authority than God, means placing ourselves above others, giving utmost importance to our schemes, latching onto one single way of life as the only and the best, replacing communion with competition, crying over crushed ambitions and thwarted plans, depending on imperfect human institutions for rights and securities, selfishly defending personal ideologies, and living a lifetime of fear. So much for that, but it's some very good things in there. Now, all right, the first thing I'll show you how we sort of structure the book, and at any time here, Carol will break in, or any of you. So we go through and we sort of ask questions, we try to answer them. Why talk about death? What is death? How natural is death? How long will I live? And here, you know, I had a sign on yesterday, it said fact. I am a fact man. Well, I took it off today because facts are pitiless. What will I die from? How will I die? How sharp is the sting of death? Is death the end? What is heaven or the kingdom of God? How do we help the dying and those who grieve? And this is one of our very important missions. And I'm appalled at how without speech and compassion we are in this regard. We shy away from it. And what kind of funeral should I have? And how do we face our own death? Now, I'm going to pick out a few of these, and we're going to discuss them. The first thing I'm going to mention very briefly is why talk about death. And a lot of people ask me this. They think, oh, you're some kind of a morbid character or something, you know? A man asked a boy one day what he wanted to do be when he grew up, and after some hesitation he said, alive. That might be asking quite a bit today. T.S. Eliot said, death is a stranger that we cannot deny. I have too many notes here today. I was going to read you something that a little boy said. It was a children's letters to God. Dear God, what is it like when you die? Nobody will tell me. I just want to know. I don't want to do it. Your friend Mike.
Isn't there a popular song out there now that says everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die?
Yeah.
That hits it too.
Yes. And there's more and more concern with this. If you go to the library and look on the books that have been put out recently on death, you'll be appalled at the increase in the last 10 years. It has been probably wisely stated that neither the sun nor death can be looked at steadily for very long. And you'll realize this when you have dealt with it, or you talk to a physician who, say, works in Children's Orthopedic at Seattle, who sees the leukemics and deals with their parents every day. When they come in, you know that it's just a matter of a very short time. And that's a hard go. So you can say, well, why look at it? My initial reply to such a question is that if you haven't got anything to say about death, you haven't got anything to say about life either. Others have said it better. Augustine, in his Confessions, pled for a keener awareness of death, not because he wished to dull the thirst for life, but for precisely the opposite reason, to intensify the self-awareness for life. Seneca said, no man enjoys the true taste of life but he who is willing and ready to quit it. Tragically today, the majority of the people are like Nisot, who was a central figure in Albert Camus' The Stranger, who said to the prison chaplain in about the only emotion he ever displayed, I have little time left, and I'm not going to waste any of it on God. Now, so much for why talk about death, and some of you may have something to say about this later. Now, what is death? And this becomes a very important question today. There are the many kinds of definitions to death. There's a social definition, there's a theological definition, and there's a biological definition. I know probably a little more about the biological definition. Carol may want to say something more about the others. But this has become so important because for a time, death was defined as a cessation of life, as manifested by the cessation of respiration and heartbeat. Now we know today that we often do not find out when this is, because we have a heart machine on, we have a we have a respiratory apparatus that keeps pumping them, as people have been maintained for up to 9 years, as with only their basal centers working. And this, you know, becomes a very important question, medically and otherwise, and socially. When sort of do you pull the tubes? And Carol and I always get into an argument sort of on this, or a big discussion, because we feel differently about this, because I have made arrangements with my family. I've told my family, and I told my son, who is now finishing up medicine, and I've made arrangements with my physician, that when the time comes, when it looks like, you know, it's here near the end, I don't want all these tubes and all these this stuff. I want to die a dignified death. And Carol tells me, you have no right to say this, you see, because you're not only living for yourself, you see. So we can get into this argument later.
I say there's no right alone to say it, because after all, Chief has something to say about it. And even those of us at second hand who love him have something to say about this opportunity to enjoy this presence of someone even who cannot respond with the normal functions to our love for him. This is one of my discussions.
Yeah, and Carol will bring this up later when we deal with a patient, and I hope he does. And it's the importance of how you handle the person who is dying, who cannot respond, because although the transmitter may be out, the receiver is still functioning. And he'll tell you a very impressive story about this on his sister. Now we are redefining death. I don't know if it's officially yet, but recently they have gone from this thing of cessation of breathing and heartbeat to a flat EEG, an electroencephalogram, a flat EEG. But recently I read where a child who was essentially declared dead because of a flat EEG made essentially a full recovery. Now, I haven't seen, you know, any verification of this, but this, of course, shakes up the troops. Because, I mean, you know, where do we go from here? But we know that if you, in about 4 to 6 minutes, your higher centers of personality and thought and are in 4 to 6 minutes, in 4 to 6 minutes following the cessation of breathing, and when it's a lack of oxygen for 4 to 6 minutes, then those centers are irreparably damaged. While the lower centers, your automatic your centers for breathing and respiration, for respiration and heartbeat and so forth, temperature regulation to an extent, these centers are probably good for maybe up to 15 minutes without oxygen. But we know that people have been brought back with long time, after long times following cessation of, say, heartbeat or breathing. But parts of us die at different rates. You know, your skin, your hair follicles may live on quite a while. I mean, various tissues may live on for quite a time, but it's become very critical now because of the transplantation problem. You see, when can you take out the kidneys? When can you take out the heart? Well, you really can't take them out till they die. But the trick is to get them out as fresh as possible. So you have a real debate here as to, you know, when do you take them out? When do you turn off the machine? And there's been some lawsuits in this regard. And it's been some very tragic things happen. We're going to skip how natural is death. How long will I live? What will I die from? Because these are statistics, and if we ever finish the book, you can read it. Is death the end? And this, of course, is a very important question. And I think it really got to me impressively on the Jack Parr show one time when I read back on what happened. I never watched the Jack Parr show, but it was following Robert Kennedy's death. And Jack Parr was a close friend of Bob Kennedy. And he started out his program that day recalling one of Robert Kennedy's favorite passages from Jacques Maritain. Having given up God so as to be self-sufficient, man has lost track of his soul. He looks in vain for himself. He turns the universe upside down, trying to find himself. And he finds masks, and behind the masks, death. And having said this, in recalling the happy days with Robert Kennedy, he says, "And the worst thing about it all is that I'll never see him again." And this is how so many people look at it. It seems that everywhere we go, we find the gaping grave swallowing up the dying. Tears of loss, of separation, of final departure, these stain every face. Everyone at some time or another tastes salt. Every table sooner or later has an empty chair, every side a vacant place. Death is a great leveler, and we can only beat sometimes our fist in utter futility against the unyielding and unresponding tomb. And this is sort of how we often sit. Yet the abolition of death is the mission of Jesus Christ. The gospel of the kingdom is the announcement of Christ's conquest over death. "This is life eternal, to know me," he says. And the Christian believes in the death of death. This belief is incomprehensible, but it is not absurd and is devoutly desired. Death is defeated through death itself. It is revealed to us only by God and accomplished through death itself, the death of the Son of God. And because of this, this death is not the final end of life, as the ultimate statistic cited by George Bernard Shaw says, when he said that one out of one dies. The ultimate statistic is not one out of one dies, but one died for all. For it answers the most burning question posed by Job so long ago. When a man dies, will he live again? Dr. Hoffman sums it up so well in these words. "If a man die, shall he live again?" is a real question asked by a real man in a real world and receives its real answer from a real God who achieved a real victory over the grave, which all of us knows to be real. And I am here to tell you that life is real. And if death is real, then this really happened. One man came, was born, lived, and died. And ever since, everything has been different. The facts are there for every intelligent man to see. Not only did Jesus Christ die, but he rose from the dead with a glory people did not know he had. This man was God speaking to men and acting for men. This is no illusion. The early Christians did not create these stories about the resurrection of Christ. It was the truth of these stories that created the Christians' hope, sustaining millions of people down through the centuries and carrying people along even to till today. It was not the love of his followers, but the power of God that raised Jesus Christ from the dead. Now, armed with this, we must have something to say to those who are dying and those who grieve. And it is that question which I would now like to address. And I'm going to read from some of this book here and some other things as time permits. And I want to say that at this point that there is a good deal of study, at least, on the dying now. For a long time it was taboo. If you went to talk to a physician saying, "Well, I want to talk to your people who are dying," you know, you'd be turned off. Or somebody that was working with these, find out that they really turned you off. Dudley over at the University of Washington was very interested in this, and whenever he got on this subject or to discuss it, they really turned him off. Now, he has a recent paper on that. He has the cooperation of many chronically ill patients because he's interested in respiratory diseases, and these people are chronically ill, and it's a matter of time, and they know it, and he now has been studying these for quite a time and has written some interesting articles on these people. My son put me on these. A more interesting one to me is what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is doing. Now, she's, I think, a Swiss physician who had a good deal of experience in working with the dying and came to Billings Hospital in Chicago. I got to know of her writings through having breakfast one day with Dr. Bauer and Joe Sittler. And Joe Sittler, I guess, knew her, how they got going on this. Four theological students came to her and asked her about dying people, and they'd like to do a study on them. So she said she'd cooperate, and of course they had some very traumatic times because they couldn't get any cooperation to do this. But now, as they got their foot in the door, now it's a rather an extensive study, and she has some rather interesting things to say about this. A couple of things that I'd like to read to you. It is hoped that this book will encourage others not to shy away from the hopelessly sick, but to get closer to them as they can help them much during the final hours. A few who can do this will also discover that it can be a mutually gratifying experience. They will learn much about the functioning of the human mind, the unique human aspects of our existence, and will emerge from the experience enriched and perhaps with fewer anxieties about their own finality. And that's sort of how she starts out. And she said she recalls some experiences of her own about a farmer dying and how he called his family in and talked to them, each one of them, and then the neighbors. And she was a small child and included in this a friend of theirs, and included also her sisters and brothers. We were allowed to share in the preparations of the family just as we were permitted to grieve with them until he died. And when he did die, he was left at home in his own beloved home, which he had built, among his friends and neighbors who went to take a last look at him where he lay in the midst of flowers in a place where he'd lived and loved so much. In that country today, there's still no make-believe slumber room, no embalming, no false makeup to pretend sleep. Only the signs of very disfiguring illnesses are covered up with bandages, and only infectious cases are removed from the home prior to burial. Now, why do I describe such old-fashioned customs? I think they are an indication of our acceptance of a final outcome, and they help the dying patient as well as his family to accept the loss of a loved one. If a patient is allowed to terminate his life in a familiar and beloved environment, it requires less adjustment for him. His own family knows him well enough to replace a sedative with a glass of his favorite wine, or the smell of home-cooked soup may give him the appetite to sip a few spoons of fluid, which I think is still more enjoyable than an infusion. And this is a physician talking now. I will not minimize the need for sedatives and infusions, and realize full well from my own experience as a country doctor that they are sometimes life-saving and often unavoidable. But I also know that patients and familiar people and foods could replace many a bottle of intravenous fluids given for the simple reason that it fulfills the physiological need without involving too many people and individual nursing care. And the fact that children are allowed to stay at home where the fatality is stricken are included in the talk, discussions, and fears gives them the feeling that they are not alone in the grief and gives them comfort of shared responsibility and shared mourning. It prepares them gradually and helps them view death as a part of life, an experience which may help them grow and mature. And she goes on to say, you know, now we have to remove the kids from this, you know, and they tell them mother has gone on a long trip, you know, and then they know, they find out, boy, they're lying to me again, huh? It is unequally unwise to tell a child who lost her brother that God loved little boys so much that he took little Johnny to heaven. When the little girl grew up to be a woman, she never solved her anger at God, which resulted in a psychotic depression when she lost her own little son 3 decades later. We should think of our great emancipation, our knowledge of science and man, has given us better ways and means to prepare ourselves and our families for this inevitable half. Instead, the days are gone when a man was allowed to die in peace and dignity in his own home. The more we are making advances in the science, the more we seem to fear and deny the reality of death. How is this possible? We use euphemisms. We make the dead look as if they were asleep. We ship the children off to protect them from anxiety and turmoil around the house if the patient is fortunate enough to die at home.
Soryatsan has a tremendous quote on that in the Cancer Ward that I hit a couple months ago, and I read it, Leo, on just that, when this famous woman, head of this cancer hospital, seeks the former head, who is now retired, and realizes she has cancer,
yes,
but wants him to tell her.
Yes.
And he realized that which modern man has not achieved is to face his death. That this is above all his present failure. This is from a famous communist novel, a very great one, The Cancer Ward by Soryatsan. But it brings in this whole conversation center of the communist world, which is, can you help us face our death, is really what the communist world is asking the Christian world today. And it's active in conversations that are being carried on. How do you face our death? This is just it.
Very good. And I think that's enough for this. Now in what she does, they make arrangements then to see various patients. They get their cooperation to talk with them, and then some of these are recorded here. And I'm just going to give you a couple of them to give you some insight into that, into these, and sort of your place in this. And also give you some insight on what they're doing. And now they've fixed it up so they can have the cooperation of the patient, and the patient can then see them if they can't come into the room. And they might have 50 or 60 people here at Billings Hospital or near there, and then and the patient can see them, but they can't see the patient sometimes. You know, it depends on the cooperation and how the patient wants it. But it's turned out there's some remarkable things that have happened here. I thought this was an interesting one. This is a girl, a teenager, who suddenly became ill with aplastic anemia, and this is fatal disease. In this case, it was a fatal disease. And they asked her, did you have a feeling of discomfort or unpleasantness about coming here and talking about us? No, I don't mind talking about it. How about the nurses handle this problem? Most of them have been real wonderful and talk a great deal, and I know most of them pretty well. And so they go on about this. And then she says, may I ask, has anybody in your family ever died since you grew up? Yes, my dad's brother and my uncle died. I went to the funeral. How do you feel? And they went on. That isn't where I wanted it.
I might say just one other footnote here where Leo was mentioning her saying this business of telling, you know, that God has taken your brother and so on. Just the problems right in the village that I've had with people at this point, severe and almost impossible to heal, because people did not curse death in the name of God, but tried to bless it in this way, as though somehow God were the God of death and not the God of the living. It is one of the amazing things that I've discovered out of very pious homes, so-called. It's one of the things that's tough. Well, like here's a girl, she has a brother, and she feels real close to him. Her mother works, she feels sort of on this basis of deserted by both father and mother, were interested more in their standard of living than in their kids. The brother dies, and they tell her, well, God has taken your brother, you see. And so she hates God, naturally, along with her parents. And rather than
this is hard to heal.
Yeah. This is just about impossible to heal. How do you do it? We didn't succeed in the summer. I sent her to Augustana Academy, where she made a mess of everything too after that. And it's just, what will her life be like? I don't know. It's a difficult one to overcome when this has just been beaten in at a moment that was tender and sensitive.
The glorious thing, though, is when she does get victory, she'll be able to minister to somebody else in that same situation in a much more effective way than perhaps even the people in the village here.
Oh, yes, but just to come over that, you know, when it wasn't necessary.
Right. You know, a lot of us have taken a lot of lumps that weren't necessary.
Yeah.
It's possible to overcome it.
Could you say more about cursing death in the name of God?
Because God is the God of the living, not of the dead. And the scriptural revelation says death is an intruder. Finally, this is the final word that scripture says about death. And so I have never had a funeral in which I did not curse death. You cannot simply say the final word about death is God's act in this. It's not. He who is called the prince of death is the devil. And so Blake says to people who do that, your God is my devil. No. And this is exactly right, because God is the God of the living, not the God of the dead. Herb has got his hand up on
it.
The last enemy.
Friend, but yeah. The word last in front of it, it's the last enemy. But it's a terrible thing to call it a friend. I hear some sermon where it's spoken of as if it was sweet death, as if it were the whole gate to paradise or something. But it's never spoken of that.
Would anyone care to offer a definition of death at this moment? It might have some importance. What is death? I've heard several definitions.
Yeah, I were you here for the beginning of this?
I wasn't. Yeah. Already
offered. We did discuss very briefly some definition of death. I mentioned there's a theological death, a social death, and I just discussed the biological death.
Very well.
But so we might come back to it.
Don't go back to it from here.
But part of it is, of course, you have to face your own, and I just wanted to show you one interview here with this young girl. And she said, if you had it to do over again, would you rather your parents had waited before telling you? This is on her, in this incurable disease, or at least what appeared to be an incurable disease, which it was. No, I'm glad right from the start. I mean, I'd rather right at the beginning and know that I have to die and that they can face me. And I discussed this, remember when we had conversations with Paul Tournier, when I discussed my meeting with Paul Tournier, and we discussed this problem of to tell or not to tell. And this is a hard problem, and he maintains that there are not very many people who can take it right now. And as I discussed in my philosophy on it, there's a lot of hot soup that you have to blow on before you can take it. And there are many, it's a very complex problem. But in this case, this girl wanted to know it. What is it that you do have to face? What's your vision of what death is like? This is one of the students. Well, I think it's a... And she says, I think it's wonderful because you go to your home, your other one, near to God, and I'm not afraid to die. And do you have a visual picture of the other home, realizing, you know, all of us have some fantasies about it, though we never talk about it. Do you mind talking about it? Well, I just kind of think it's like a reunion where everybody is there and it's real nice, and where there's someone else there special that you know kind of makes the whole thing different. Is there anything else that you would say on how you feel about it? And they're trying to get the feelings, you see, of these patients. And they seem really to look forward to their coming to do this. Oh, you would say you have a wonderful feeling, no more needs, and just being there and never again alone. Because the being alone really got to her. As it gets to most of these, this feeling of being alone. And this is one of the real regrets of my life, that I wasn't there when my father died, or just before it. I'd been to see him. I was in the East. I didn't know he was critical. And the next thing I know, he's dead. And probably without any member of the family being there. And this aloneness at life's most dramatic moment is, I really feel very strongly about this.
This is what I was saying about the old-fashioned ministry that was there and how great that old-fashioned ministry was that was there. I mentioned one time, just in talking about this, the first pastor I worked under was speaking about every pastor is given 10 pounds of pressure. He says, I put on about 9. He says, my neighbor over in Wilmer maybe puts on 2, but I'd trust him if I were dying. He wouldn't let me down, see? And this, the old-fashioned pastor wouldn't. He was there to minister to your ultimate needs, not to say, hello, how are you doing? I told a little story about Stavig with Rovog. Rovog's a famous writer of novels, of some of you who don't know, and he came into him as a young pastor and sort of intimidated and talked to him what's going on. He says, listen here, I'm sick and I may be sick unto death. You're my pastor and you're just talking to me? He says, you're responsible for me to God. Aren't you going to do more with me than that? And he says, Stavig says he never forgot. This really got to him as a young pastor. But this, what do you do in this hour? And this is where Luther is so wonderful. You lay hold of this person with a promise. You push Christ upon you. And I just mentioned here about my sister sinking into a coma and dying of cancer. And she'd come out of these comas after 2 or 3 hours, and she sank into one. I said, sis, fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold of eternal life. And she mentioned as she came out of that coma how throughout this whole time she was under, this was rolling around in her mind and laying hold of her. And this is what you do. And I mentioned how an old pastor was dying and Oslo was sort of the friend of every student over there. And the days before we could afford a fellow in Oslo, which we have now, but he was really this then. And we went to see him at Christmas time because he thought he was dying and he couldn't respond at all. And there was no response. And I prayed for him, gave him the benediction and gave him a promise. And when I came back later, he had speech restored to him. And he said, well, He said, the first thing he said in his own humor, he says, I guess it wouldn't have been good to gone home yet if my father didn't want me. But he said it would have been nice to have gone home for Christmas. Actually, he died on Easter Day. He had the same birthday as my wife, so I was back on the 29th of December when he could talk again. And he said, you know, all through Christmas when I couldn't respond, he says, I was under, he says, your word of peace was holding me in God's hand. You see, this ministry to each other. And how we have left this behind, I don't know. I mean, we're no longer pastors, but psychiatric agents, and we've forgotten that, I guess.
I think that's so important that even though they're going unconscious, their hearing is the last of the elements that is cut out.
Yeah.
They can hear what you say and what your attitudes. And often they say, as long as they can't talk back, they talk about anything. Boy,
there's been some real tragic incidents in this regard.
Yeah, I know
in one case,
the
family, I think it was grandmother or something, and she had a good deal of wealth. And the family then was dividing it up. See? And they were talking, well, you'll get this and you'll get this. And she did recover, you see, and she heard all of this. And she just lived in despair from there on. I mean, it was an awful thing, an awful thing.
You can still minister to
and,
them.
And,
sorry. Thing I found too that when the doctor says they can no longer respond and presumably everybody thinks they can't hear, that I found in some cases if you sing, especially if you sing something they know, they respond. One of the first person I ever had in my ministry was a woman, 97 years old, had this death rattle, and they were all talking as though she couldn't hear a thing and were really gone. And I started talking, they said, you're wasting your time, but I insisted anyway, and then I sang, this grief that Jesus formed yet, because that figure in her childhood she probably had it.
Yeah.
Suddenly she tried to sing it with me.
Yeah.
Now, apparently singing will often reach through, but maybe she was singing in protest, Carol said.
But here's one reason I love Herb. Herb's a German, and he's given a parish where he can't do anybody any harm by our church. It doesn't even have a railroad track going through it, you know. And it's all Norwegian. He learns Norwegian so he can minister to the old people in Norwegian and memorizes his old Norwegian hymns so he can minister to them. This is what you mean by being a pastor.
See, that's so important because that's the first language you learned, and a lot of times you go back
that's
to that.
That's the one you got left.
I mean, and my mother, you know, when I saw her for the last time, I mean, she in her condition at that time was quite critical, and she showed some recovery, but at that time, I mean, she could still say the 23rd Psalm, you know? Yes, and did you have something?
Someone had something.
Well, I was going to say one of the most wonderful things that I have seen or heard about. Some of you may have known Julian Sletten from Minneapolis. And his wife is a dear friend of mine. She was telling about when he died, how he had cancer and was suffering for quite a while. But he told her not to mourn because he said, I'm just looking forward to this. It's the greatest adventure that I've ever experienced, he said, and it's going to be wonderful. And his death was so beautiful, according to Olga.
Now, I want to go here and recall for you, sort of to bring this home, I think, very poignantly. Now, this is a lady. At 2 and a half, when her parents were divorced, she was raised by relatives. Her only daughter died at 2 and a half, and this was from tuberculosis, while her husband was in the service. She had no one else as close as this little girl. Soon afterwards, she lost her father in a sanatorium and had to be hospitalized herself with tuberculosis. After 22 years of marriage, her husband left her with her two small boys for another woman. A family doctor, whom she had great confidence and trust, died when she needed him the most, namely when she noticed a suspicious lump, which later proved malignant. Raising the boys alone, she postponed treatment until the pain became unbearable and her malignancy was spread. In all her misery and loneliness, she always found some meaningful friends, however, with whom she was able to share concerns. And this is where I think we come in. And now let's just go back to this, and I'll show you part of the interview. And she had a brother, but she wasn't close to him. And she tells about her friend of 5 years. He's a man. He's a very nice person. He's been very good to me, and he's been good to the boys. I mean, since I've had to be away from the boys, he has been overseeing them, seeing that someone was there with them to get their meals at night to be with him. I mean, they aren't entirely alone. You know, entirely on their own, of course. The older boy probably would be responsible enough, but he's still a minor, I feel, until he is 21. You feel more comfortable with somebody there, yes? And then I have a neighbor there. It's more like a duplex, and she lives in the other half of the house, and she's in and out every day, and she's been helping with my housework at home. And between those 2 months that I was home, she took care of me, you know. She'd give me my baths and see that I had meals to eat. She's a very wonderful person. She's a very religious person, you know, in her own faith, and she has done just an awful lot for me. What faith does she have? I don't really know. I don't know what church she goes to. Protestant? Yes, she thought so. Do you have other family or this? I have a brother who lives here, but he wasn't close to her. Then she says, well, you're lucky to have this friend. She's wonderful. I've just never known anyone like her. Nearly every day I get a card or a few lines in the mail from her. It might be silly, it might be serious, but I mean, I even look forward to just hearing from her because, you know, she was now brought to another hospital. Now, this is a person that knew her, what? Less than 2 years, huh? And she's the real hold. She's the one that means the most to her. And all I can say is go out and do likewise, you know? Just that somebody cares. And this is so important in this. And I know many of you, as I have been faced, we as laymen, sometimes we get called in, the pastor isn't available, but a lot of times we have this ministry that is a very important one, and I've been in situations where the physician and nobody, they didn't know what to say. But it is important under these circumstances, even if you don't know what to say, to listen. I recalled for you when I talked to Turnier, you know, and I recalled some incidents in my life, I mean some very tragic things. And I said, what do you say? Almost, you know, in desperation. What do you say? You know, here's a man who's been dealing with this kind of a thing all his life. And he thought for quite a while, and he says, I do a lot of listening. Because it's important that they express themselves. But he says, sometimes I do not know what to say. And sometimes what I do, sometimes I don't know what to say, and I do better if I can think about it and write it down. And sometimes it's useful to do this. And recently I had occasion to do this, and it was a very unfortunate thing. I guess he was about 27 months old. It was the firstborn of this family. She'd been married before, had two older children, and she'd marry again. It was a wonderful marriage, and they had this son who was now 27 months old, and this was not very long ago. And she missed him for just a few minutes and found him dead in the neighbor's pool. Now, what do you say in a circumstance like this? Well, we have a small congregation, of course. In a case like this, everybody tastes salt. You know what I mean by that? You know? And they brought in the food and they went and sat with the family and did a lot of things. But sometimes you can help by writing. Now, and I hope they, I don't expect they'll ever say anything about this. I know they've said something to other people that this was meaningful to them. So I'm just giving you, we have the ministry also of the word. And it is on this that I would like to recall. But before I say that, and I don't have time to read it now, but in the hospital, it's very important for those of you who deal around the dying, that cheerfulness really, really helps a very great deal, and that you have to respect the wishes, not of the great God routine in the hospital, which we do respect. I mean, it's the great God routine and not the patient that has the most to say about it. I think we should start listening to the patient. And this is brought out so much with this teenager I told you about and her mother, and they had a depth interview with her mother, and she told some very damaging things that have been very helpful, of course, to the Billings hospital staff, because they find out just what's going on. They found out that some of the staff they were afraid of them, or they set up, I mean, it was really awful, and finally it got to them, so they replaced them. And she said it was such a relief. And then the next night, a nice tall colored boy came into our door and said, good evening, I'm here to make your night more cheerful. And his whole attitude was great. All night long he came in when I pushed the bell. He was just wonderful. And the next morning both patients in the room were 100% better. And this makes the day so much better. I mean, you have this ministry where you can change the whole atmosphere of the thing. Now, on this letter I wrote, and boy, I really sweat over this, and I call it two sherets on tasting salt. For many weeks now, I have been putting some things on paper in the hope of conveying to you some comfort at a time when you have been tasting salt so often. In the tragedy that overwhelmed you and all of us, we searched for explanations, and all we seemed to find are more questions and empty rooms. In preparing a Vesper talk on joy, and I was already thinking of what I'm going to say about joy ever since I told you, you know, the last Sunday night. And this thing had been bugging me ever since last summer when somebody here says, you somebody better say something on joy. I was reminded that our life as Christians is a comedy. It is a comedy not because it is full of jokes. You know better than most that it is fraught with tragedy. But we live in the assurance that it all comes out right in the end for those who are one with God. The final word is in Jesus Christ. God's answer is an affirming love to man in Jesus. Easter is not a puzzle, but a solution. It is not an argument, but a shout of triumph. Not a dark mystery, but a song of joy. God's word is still yes, not no. Life, not death. But when death comes, the one who is taken, the one who is gone, seems to invade the mind the more. Perhaps it is because in this strange company we are at one with those who are gone. But the ache and emptiness is there, for we are also fiercely tied to the touch of a hand, a gleam in the eye, and a sound of a voice. I have received much comfort from the enclosed eulogy by a friend of mine, Al Rognes, and much of this is taken from him because he is such a compassionate man. He's meant much to me and many people. I'm sure more than he'll ever realize. And I says, he wrote the following on the death of his son, and I pray it will give comfort to you. And then I sent him this thing which I'm going to read to you now, and I know some of you have probably read it before. He had been center on the football team, steersman on the crew, childhood, high school, Christian College, Oxford. The years had mounted upward in a spiraling crescendo. In George MacDonald's words, he was a green-faced, pure-eyed, strong-willed, high-hearted boy, and the rising plateaus were before him. Suddenly, his youth, his life was ended. The roar of a motor on a broken body on a city street. Youth is not a preparation for life. Youth is life itself. There is no time for rehearsal. The great play is on. Every day is another little block of time in which to live, to love, to serve, to weep, to laugh. You cannot employ today only to set the stage for tomorrow, for there may be no tomorrow. Long years ago, a youth of 33 writhed to his death on a cross. Across the centuries, this young man summons other young men and women to join him and to give him the vibrant, aspiring years of their youth. These years may be the only ones that can be given, for there may be no more. And what years they are. Exuberant, gay, warm, sensitive years. And if the Lord can have these years, then he has captured the best. Perhaps these are enough for him. You may have 70 to give him. You may have but 104. However long or short, having given him your years, when death makes his capricious attack, the Lord of the cross and the empty grave will set you on your feet again and put you to work in the imperishable sectors of his kingdom. And then I closed with this. Perhaps 28 months was enough. As a lovely child comes from the Lord, ask counsel and comfort from him with love. And so I my prayer in departing from here is that you will remember that what are we here for but to help other people. And other people at a time when they really need help and comfort. And as Eleanor Orler wrote to me when my father died, because she knows very well how it is to taste salt. And she is sitting on my right. And she wrote and said, you know, the days, many days after death, then the loneliness sets in, and that's often when we forget, you know. We as friends forget, you know. We minister for a couple of days and then you go on. But the ache and emptiness is there, and it is up to us still to minister.
And it's never over. This idea that time heals is just crazy. Al suffers as much in this hour as in the hour when he wrote that on Paul. And I think part of the reason why he wants to opt out of being even a candidate for president of the ALC is he still has this feeling of why, what's the use? Paul, who had all this tremendous gift and wiped out, and you know, it just doesn't make life come out. And this is the way he feels at times. This grief goes all the way through and affects even, I think, moments his crucial decisions in administration. Grief is this way. You're never through with it. You're not done with it this side of heaven. We're not done with it.
I wonder though if in your book you shouldn't, maybe you're going to, I don't know. I think it'd be really important if you would treat with grief.
Oh yes, yes, yes. As there's a chapter,
today,
yes.
Now, we're
yes.
so superficial on it, yeah. It just gets
it's
me.
It's really important.
It's like I've said to people who've had sudden death and that I've heard about. I write to them from here when I hear about it. I say, come up, let us weep with you. We had one doctor like this last year sitting sharing this whole thing with us, whose daughter was killed with her baby daughter on her lap killed. She was driving to a Christian day school during the summer. I mean, she's teaching a summer vacation Bible school, you know. And you just think of these things that come.
Have you thought anything, excuse me, along this line of grief, also saying something about, well, I don't know how to express it except to say what I've learned to call it, the cult of life.
Yeah.
You know, as if this life is really all.
Yeah.
I don't say, you know, it's a wonderful, glorious, happy thing. Naturally, it isn't. But it is something since Christ. More than it ever was, and moving through this experience.
Yeah,
the cult of life is that this is all we got, and it is.
Yeah, because you do have a foretaste, I think, of the kingdom of God here on earth, and perhaps some of you don't agree, but I mean, I think we have moments here in Holden, at least to me, you have a foretaste of the kingdom of God, and probably the most impressive one of these, as far as dimension goes, I think, occurred back some years ago, when probably one of the will go down in history as one of the great men of this nation, in probably some of the finest oratory ever given to us, was when I Have a Dream, and Martin Luther, and I want to just recall that for you. And perhaps some of you will disagree to this, but you remember he said he saw this whole crowd, and nobody can be unimpressed with 250,000 people in front of him. I mean, none of you will ever have that experience, you know, but he did. And the response of the crowd, he chucked his notes, and he said, "I say to you today, even though we face difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. There's a dream that is deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even in the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with people's injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children one day will live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And when we allow freedom to ring from every town and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Great God Almighty, we are free at last." And then this commentator said, as Martin ended his speech, there was the awed silence that is the greatest tribute to an orator that can be paid. And then came a tremendous crash of a sound as 250,000 people shouted in ecstatic accord with his words. The feeling that they had of oneness and unity was complete. They kept on shouting in one thunderous voice. And for that brief moment, the kingdom of God seemed to have come on earth. And I think we have this. And I asked Willie, who's there. Willie Hertz. Well, who's here? And he said, I thought it was the kingdom of God for a moment. And so we do have that foretaste. But life has to have some meaning for us. And even people like Camus, he says, here is what frightens me. To lose one's life is a little thing. I will have the courage when necessary. But to see the sense of this life dissipated, to see a reason for existence, that is what is intolerable. A man cannot live without meaning.
Paul Al's son, for instance, was killed 10 minutes from home after 2 years away as he was in always saving money, driving a car back from Detroit, you know, that you could drive back free to Minneapolis for one of the dealers. Something had conked out and the engine gotten out to look at it, and a big semi came along and hit him in the downtown streets of St. Paul, right down Main Street down there. Didn't leave enough left to look at. A beautiful guy, just a beautiful guy. And you just ask yourself, when I heard about it, just with shock, we simply went over and parked outside the house to pray. How can you get over it?
And Carol preached the sermon for the funeral.
Yeah. You come in, his mother had 26 roses. Because Paul always gave her on her birthday the number of roses for her birthday. And I'm supposed to preach. Oh, how do you preach? Well, I had fun at first. I take off from Herb a little bit. Paul, you know, in Philippians, and he, not being anxious, you know, he desires to depart and be with Christ, which is far better, and then the next breath he says, but God spared us sorrow upon sorrow. He didn't let our friend die. Well, there you have right away this whole complex, don't you? Just a few verses from Paul the Apostle. He just said, it's better to depart and be with Christ. He says, but God saved us sorrow upon sorrow and left us our servant and friend with us. I mean, not to say this, not to allow the whole complex to be said. I just spoke about the three Pauls. Paul, the apostle in that moment. Paul, Gerhardt. And I sing to thee with voice and well. I sing to thee with voice and heart of all my joys the well. I sing that what I know thou art, my tongue to all may tell. That thou a fountain art of grace, with blessings richly stored for all in every time and place. This well I know, O Lord, even in this tragic moment, in this absolutely nonsensical moment, and it is nonsense, you see. How else can you see it? I mean, how can you live in a world of death and simply be casual about it? But you see, this is like Edna says, why many people will not come to the village, because it makes them confront their own. You can't take off these moments apart and not be confronted with your own. Many people don't want to take vacations. It makes them feel immediately that they can get along without me. No. This is the way in which we try to live without this haunting dread, and yet it's there. How do we confront it? How do we live with it? And I say myself, first of all, it's the only way we become human. This limits that's there. It's the only way which beauty becomes meaningful to us. A person who lives without a convalescence attitude towards life isn't really alive, is he? When you've really been stricken unto death and you come alive again, the flowers are really colorful for the first time you're seeing it. The sounds of children's playing are so cute that will shatter your eardrums. Life is real. To live without that sense of reality, life is to be dead already. You say, what is death? And that is death. That's the first death from which we're spared when we face stars. And each day is anew from God's hand. And there is that. But this is what makes life, in any sense, have its poetry. The pagan Japanese, it says, out across the wave, all is bare, not a fallen leaf, not a flower there, only over thatched huts, fallen brief, twilight and the lonely autumn air. He's facing his death, and autumn is coming alive for him with something of its poignancy. person who's running away from his death hasn't got any poetry, he hasn't got nothing. You see, he's just running, isn't he? And that's the way most people are, they're running. They've never become human, you see, just that part of it. There is this side of it we have to face. And yet when we do face God in it, then we see that death is an intruder, that it's not ultimate, that it's not final, it is the last enemy. And not to see it in this sense is not to see it. Not to be armed against it is to go absolutely absurd into our own future. There isn't a confirmant I ever trained, but what I didn't say, have at your hand a hymn that you can die with. The one you sang last night with this hands business, nothing in my hands I bring. Then Satan can't get you to look at your hands in that final hour. You're looking at his. And you know the hands of Christ were very frail, for they were broken by a nail, but only they reach heaven at last, to whom those frail broken hands hold fast. His hands save you, not yours. And this you need, because you're going to be tempted to look at yours. There isn't one of us that isn't. There's one of us who speaks in his name, but doesn't suddenly think, even as he's speaking his name, if you come in this hour, you know, what a frump, what a real phony I am. Talk about digging a hole in the earth to hide in it. That's one of those graphic visions in Revelations, what men are going to do. And you can sense this unless you confront this. And then to see it in its whole demonic aspect, because it still has this, and it's part of the lie. Because finally and ultimately it is true, he that liveth and believeth in me shall never die. That God is the God of the living and not of the dead. That remains in spite of all our Hebrew exegesis today.
Mm-hmm. Why curse it? Why curse it?
Because it still is an intruder.
It's an intruder, yes. But you know, you said this the other day, it kind of shook me up, and I've been thinking about it now and then ever since. Right up there in about here. But do you really have to curse it? You know, there are some cases I can think of, and you can too, where death has been a real blessing.
Oh, yeah.
And we thank God for it.
Because pain is that terrible.
Yeah, so you don't have to curse it. You can be angry about it, you know.
Well, in that sense, you're still cursing it when you're angry, aren't you?
Well, not necessarily. I think there's a righteous anger. Yeah. And in that sense, you know, you curse it, maybe. But I know of deaths where I've been able to thank God with the family, you know, that this has happened. Because there is that beyond death that we all are striving for.
There are those for whom the years turn out. They've had a long life full of years and happy days, and you just simply say you welcome it. Mary's father was certainly that. But that happens, certainly, in that sense of our human context. And you say, if this were all, it was great, you know.
Right.
If this were all, it was great. I remember taking him up to Concordia, where he'd been president earlier, and he wasn't talking about his years as president, he was talking his years as pastor when he was really relating to people, you know. And I said, man, I used to fear your retirement. I thought it'd be terrible, because he was a very hard-boiled, tough guy that was a terror to every Norwegian that was born in America, but he didn't dare leave the church, you know, and that's how he kept them together. And this is the kind of guy he was, sort of. And he was just tender and delightful with the kids and gave the grandchildren a memory. And I said, you know, greater is he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. I said, you know, greater than his whole life. And he was the intimate of kings, and he was a jolly farm boy. He never lost the sense of that, so he related with the farmer with his old suspenders on and with the great, and equally at ease, you know. But just that he was a human being in this thing. And this is great. But then you have a Paul Rodness right at the start. With everything on the ball that old J.A. had, who would have been for his day that kind of a leader.
For Paul Rodness, you can curse death.
Yeah.
But for the old 85-year-old grandmother who has lived her life and longing for it, you can't curse it.
Yes, you can.
If you curse death, are you questioning God? Look, she has the...
God has cursed death already.
A person who's come this far, experiences pain and disability and so forth, has the equivalence of death already there.
Yeah.
That's the part that you curse, the fact that there should be debilitation. I mean, if we are spirits, we're meant to grow and to move into intimacy with God, and this is an intrusion. The whole business of dying.
Depends on what you define as death, I guess.
I resent the fact that I must die. I mean, I like to live, and belief bothers me at times. I mean, I would wish for continuity.
Well, isn't there continuity? I mean...
In one sense, yes, but I may not be conscious of the continuity. I longed for it just continued to grow and moving into the fullness of
it. It's better to die than be with Christ.
No, that's what I mean.
Yeah. And that says there's discontinuity.
You see, you know it's written. Now, there was a time in prison camp when if you'd taken a vote, there wasn't any question about the fact you would have had a majority vote even amongst the pagans. Let's die. It's a lot better to die and carry on like this. I mean, there's a moment when that came. In fact, you could tell it in our preaching, because our preaching moved by this atmosphere was continually saying, you've got to claim life. You've got to lay hold of it. I mean, you hear this today when people say they'd rather not live through the atomic bomb. And I tell them it's the Christian's duty to live through. You're going to have to lay hold of every bit of life you can with whatever kind of distortions and degeneracies happen to this body out of that atomic atmosphere and live through it, because it's your duty to claim life. The Christian above all is to love life. But it's tough. Now, in prison camp, for instance, what helped us there more than our Christian faith was a sense of the race. I mean, we remind ourselves how they made bread out of bark. What have we gone through before to get you here amongst your forebears? I mean, when you're really up against it, this hits you. Boy, back sometime, what have they done just to keep you alive and coming this far? That was the thing that we held on to us more than our Christian faith, because our Christian faith did say to us, in a sense it betrayed us that moment, said it's better to depart and be with Christ. And it was our job right then above all to hang on. Now this was a tough thing, because take for instance, after we were released even, I think of the night out at Villabid Shoe Factory, where this came most poignant to us all. One boy, quite loud, and it just happened to be the man next to us, a dear friend of us, whom we all visited through the night, so we all had a chance to hear this going on. They were giving him blood plasma. We were in the midst of bombardment. They had taken us out of, because the Japanese counterattacked, and they'd taken us out of where we were, and we were back about 3 miles. And all in this big, huge shoe factory place, and this one area as large as an ordinary gym, where most of them were insane from starvation, see? Just plain insane from starvation. And one guy right next to this fellow we were visiting, and he was saying, oh, let me die, let me die, let me die, let me die. Now, there were 3 nurses and 1 doctor and that one guy. All night, trying to pull him back into life, but he had no will to live, see? It had gone. And in the morning, he was dead. Everybody there pulling for him for life, but death, too big a hold on him. And that's the way it is for most people in this world. Let's face it, they're saying, let me die. They're saying, that's all there is. I'll sign up for it. They're saying, it's too big a risk, this resurrection business of yours. Let me die. I mean, the laughter of my father guy who wrote The Simian World. Let's settle for it. We're either fallen sons of God or we're apes on the way up, and we're not very far along. I choose death, you see.
That's the danger.
But do we fear our own death, or do we fear the death of our loved ones? Or do we?
You raised a real issue here that was really poignant for all of us, where we no longer faced each other. The suffering, as we'd say, when you hit this is what you realize. Affliction comes to us all, death comes to us all. But it's love that creates the suffering in it, see? And in a sense, your love of yourself, if it's a true love, you see. Also, it comes into this. But your love of each other, what was happening to those around me, to see them. To see, for instance, the kind of light of intelligence that just, you know, gives me a burst of joy in a guy like Herb, gone. Memory gone. We couldn't remember each other. You know, awful what happens to you under this. It isn't just the final death, but all the deaths that have taken place before. The 2 times I've really wept in my life was once in the pulpit when we lost China, and the other time in prison camp when I'd lost my memory. And it took me over a week to try to do what I'd done in 2 hours at the seminary, and that's go through Sasse's Here We Stand, you know, and give a review on it. And you could no longer embrace the material. You couldn't hold it. You couldn't allow your mind to kind of organize this and bring it into focus. Well, that's a death for anybody who's a scholar. That's tough to take. But your deaths are so many, aren't they?
I think that seeing the suffering of your loved ones might make you want to die, just to release you from the pain of seeing the other
them suffer. Well, I remember when I went to the hospital, I had less than a million blood count. My little daughter was a little over 3. And she said, don't close your eyes, Daddy. Don't close your eyes, Daddy. You know, I wanted to die. But boy, her life was claiming my life, you see.
It works both ways, I guess.
Yeah. Well, this is the real thing. This is our human context, isn't it? It makes us really human. And apart from death, would we be? You see, this is the story in legend form, if you wish, in the Old Testament. So they lived those 800-900 years, and all they did was foul each other up. So God limited them to 70 years, and if by reason of strength, 80. So you might really have a chance to become a human being.
But maybe that's why we can't curse death.
Yeah, I suppose in this ultimate sense, but yet,
I see death as an intruder, but at the same time, it's that which enriches, isn't it?
Most
it makes us appreciate, it makes us love, and makes us grasp hold of what we have. You know, and it makes the human dimension so much richer than to think, well, it'll happen forever and ever and ever and ever, and there's no really, no big deal about it. Then it also gives the eternal.
And yet you can't finally come to an acceptance or terms with it. It is the last enemy. And there is a fight, isn't it? It is a fight, the good fight of faith, lay hold of eternal life. You can't accept this as the ultimate answer to man. The grave wasn't the goal.
But even in God's grace, death may not have come from the hand of God, but at the same time, God uses that.
To shape us up? This is right.
Not to shape us up, but to give us an appreciation and an enrichment that would not be there, I'm afraid, otherwise. I can enjoy today because maybe today's the last one I'll have.
Yeah, that's right. This comes to us all. And out of that, I was profoundly affected by Dave Brown, who was my success in the youth movement, who pushed the youth movement over and strong in this whole social action gambit, who came up with this statement in our little rendezvous here in April, that really he had, without being cynical, he said, just plain realistic appraisal of this whole response of youth to hunger and so on, all it is their own death. I mean, what is it that makes us aware of our neighbor, you see? Our own death. The hunger might hit us. It's pretty hard to feel his hunger, but it might hit me. And so I go on a march for hunger. This is what he was saying. And it could sound like a cynical remark, and yet I'm afraid it's ultimately true one. That it is death that makes us human to each other. This is the possibility that's there. This is what he was saying.
That's a paradox.
No.
Death is the meaning of life. In the sense, that's what it's all about. No.
Because, a lot of us have felt this youth generation today is really with it and has gotten something, in a sense, of courage that our own generation didn't have. We were told to wait till we're 55 and then publish our books, and this is what happened to my first one that went to Augsburg, and so on. And this is sort of what we accepted. All right, we'll wait, our day will come. Never it does. But they've said, no, it's the now generation. And this is something profoundly right about it. And I appreciate this so much, and yet it is the sense of their death that's so real to them, because the atomic bomb, this whole situation in which we have been confronted, is so much more poignant for anybody who's got feelings. I mean, like John has mentioned, this poetry from the sixth floor of the psychiatric ward in Rochester and so on, and I said to people, it's pretty hard to understand a youth today who hasn't blown his brains once, How do they manage to grow up without getting through a psychiatric ward? I don't understand. And if I were grown up today, I don't know if I could miss one. Because death has become so appalling in our capacity to afflict it, hasn't it? Before it was my death, now it's everybody. And I have an awful feeling inside of me, and this will be about as most cynical remark I suppose anyone can make, that not least behind this whole thing is a cowardice that a guy is afraid to commit suicide, but he doesn't mind pulling a button that pulls us all out from underneath. He hates his own life that much that he wants to take all of us with him. That some of this is behind this whole thing. That makes me worry. This came into this one comedy that this brother we got on movie this afternoon. It should be a fun movie. But remember that one when he's in the wheelchair, Dr. Strangelove? Yeah. You had this, A crippled scientist's hatred of life, a screwed up militarist's hatred of life. Take us all with him. And I think some of this is at work in it. I don't think we can escape. Because man won't face his own death, so he'd rather pull down the whole house. So it's a real issue that's at the center. Well, somebody else is ready to think, aren't they? I don't want to take out
time. 10:30 on the